KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want next time.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right, like peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood, Hollywood.
This week on The Business, the unique and incomparable filmmaker Werner Herzog talks about his fascination with death row, his take-no-prisoners approach to filmmaking, and about playing the villain in movies, even though he's really a fluffy husband. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood, Hollywood, Hollywood.
I'm joined in the studio by my fellow banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, I recently got to go to a special preview for the media at Paramount. James Cameron showed 18 minutes of his laboriously reworked Titanic in 3D.
So 18 minutes, meaning there's 3.5 hours still to go?
3.5 hours to go. Actually, the 18 minutes jumped around through the movie to remind you of certain beats, you know, of the film. Kate Winslet shows up at the docks. Kate Winslet getting to know Leo DiCaprio, and a very, very young Leo DiCaprio. And, of course, something bad happens to the ship. I don't want to spoil it. But, yes, 18 minutes.
It does not get hit by a 2D iceberg. It gets taken up by a 3D iceberg. I mean, Jim Cameron, it's interesting to note, because Jim Cameron was somebody who very early on said he was against 3D conversions. Now, I guess he's a big proponent of it. And following the great success of The Lion King in 3D, I think Paramount is probably pretty excited about this as well.
Well, Paramount and Fox, that's primarily Fox, but Paramount's distributing. And they are, I predict, here for the world to hear, they are going to make a bloody fortune. I mean, whether you thought Titanic was the greatest movie ever or not, I got to tell you, that 3D, I mean, what Jim Cameron is opposed to is bad 3D conversion. And he wasn't persuaded in this case by The Lion King. He was planning this already because he was going to do it his way. And whatever you might think about Jim Cameron and his ego and his King of the World speech at the Oscars and his movies, love them, hate them, this is a guy who truly knows what he's doing when it comes to this stuff. And I got to tell you, it looked pretty darn good.
I can already start singing Celine Dion.
Well, there was plenty of that. He's spending $18 million. Well, somebody is spending $18 million, not him, to get it just right, laboriously working. It's coming out in April 2012. And I predict that mothers and their children will be lined up with their hankies in hand. And I truly believe this movie will gross hundreds of millions of dollars.
Okay, you heard it here first.
You heard it here. Not doing quite so well right now is NBC, which, you know, NBC has had a new chief for some time now, Robert Greenblatt, but we all knew he came in. These were not the shows that he had developed, although he did put them on the schedule. And we said on the show, I think, that he would get a pass for part of the season, but now watching it grind along, oh, it feels like a long and awful slog.
No, and it really feels like NBC and Comcast are going to have to start spending money to make money. It doesn't feel as if a cheap replacement like the Brian Williams News Show is going to be the answer to their problems.
Yeah, I mean, they've already canceled two shows, The Playboy Club and Free Agents, which is quite a lot this stage of the game, and certainly not what Bob Greenblatt would have wanted to do. And their other shows are just gasping, a lot of them, for air. And they cannot get Prime Suspect launched. Harry's Law is reaching new lows, I mean, which had been working for them to some degree. When you have nothing that's really a big hit to promote a new show on, and you have, let's just say, maybe not a great supply of wonderful new shows to promote, man, is it hard. And, you know, the cable networks are killing, and the broadcast network is just gasping for air.
Cable networks at every company, at News Corp, at Time Warner, certainly at Comcast or where all the money is. But if you don't have a network, you know, some of that product occasionally does feed into your cable network. So if you cut off the network, then you may be a little bit more hard-strapped to find programs to show on your cable channels.
And to be specific, you know, USA, which belongs to Comcast and NBC Universal, is a gigantic moneymaker and established itself largely with reruns of various Law & Order iterations. And that is a very key thing, as we've seen where, you know, the Oprah Winfrey Network has been trying to launch without that kind of stuff, and it's been a disaster. So the challenges are really clear, and Comcast is spending. Right now, other networks are complaining about the amount of spending because NBC is buying up a lot of stuff and driving up prices. Normal development season is about $30 million. My colleague reported recently that NBC is significantly overspending that normal amount.
And the people I talked to at the movie studio say that Comcast is spending a ton of money, more so than GE was spending on the film slate. The question is, you spend a lot of money, you get the Yankees that win the World Series, or do you get the Yankees that are eliminated in the playoffs?
Time will tell. Meanwhile, among all this corporate money sloshing around, we're going to possibly give a word of warning to the Occupy Wall Street folks here in Los Angeles and around the country, even around the world. They have a mask that they are wearing, which is the Guy Fawkes mask made popular in V for Vendetta, which was a movie, and before that, comic novels. But is there something they should know about these masks, John?
Well, the masks are supposed to represent, you know, the small guy taking on the man of its government, of its corporations. But these masks are licensed by Warner Brothers, which is a part of Time Warner. So the Occupy whatever people around the world, by wearing these masks, are actually putting money directly into the pockets of Time Warner.
Lining the pockets of the giant corporation. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. German filmmaker Werner Herzog has completed 57 films and counting. He keeps a running ticker on the homepage of his website. Most of his films have been documentaries of varying lengths on subjects as diverse as the life of a Vietnam War POW, the fires of the Kuwaiti oil fields, and the life and death of a man who could not stay away from grizzly bears. Whatever the subject, Herzog approaches his work fearlessly. His latest movie, Into the Abyss, is a documentary about death row. The film recounts the harrowing details of a triple murder, and Herzog sits down to talk with the disturbingly boyish killer, Michael Perry, just days before his execution.
You know, as the days get closer, I can feel the pressure on my shoulders. They call it clinical depression, where I just start having less motivation to do things, less energy. You get frustrated at the system. How can they not see, you know, my situation is wrong? You know, I used to write all the time and have a lot of energy, and I just don't have it anymore. I just feel like I've been beaten down.
I have the feeling that destiny, in a way, has dealt you a very bad deck of cards. It does not exonerate you. And when I talk to you, it does not necessarily mean that I have to like you. But I respect you, and you are a human being, and I think human beings should not be executed.
Since Herzog has done so many interviews, or conversations as he calls them, I expected when he came in that he would have a certain empathy for the role of the questioner. But as we started the talk, he took off his watch, placed it in front of him, and announced that he would speak for exactly 30 minutes. No more, no less.
I will fall silent in the middle of a sentence.
He's very strict about this. I'm trying to talk him out of it, but he refuses to be convinced.
Yes, it's not professional to just let the tape run and run and run and run.
Well, we don't do that.
You'll get 300 hours of mediocre stuff. You'll never make anything of substance out of 300 hours of mediocre. Mediocrity.
300 hours promise you never our plan.
Yeah, no, but sometimes filmmakers even boast that they have 300, 400 hours of footage. You know how much I had for Into the Abyss? 8 hours.
Oh, I heard 10. It's 8?
Well, 10, maybe 10, yes.
All right. I'm going to try and move along. Well, if you're going to give me 30 minutes, then you have to be pungent and succinct.
Yeah. I have my watch ticking here right in front of me.
We've never been under this kind of pressure before.
You better do the substantial questions right now.
Well, there are many. All right, let me start with Into the Abyss. How did it come together to make this film now? And I've heard you've long wanted to make a film about death row.
Well, not exactly death row. In fact, my very earliest film that I ever wanted to make when I was 15, 16 was on maximum security prison in Bavaria. I came across some correspondence of that time just recently, and I must say I have to thank God on my knees that I never made it at that time. It was just immature, and it, in a way also stupid. So, but I've been fascinated by it. And of course, death row, where you have people who are different than us because we do not know when we are going to die and we do not know how we are going to die, but they know exactly. So that makes a difference between them that is very fascinating for me to explore.
And so how did it come together now that you were doing this film? I mean, in a normal world of Hollywood, you say death row and this guy's going to die in 8 days. And most, I don't know, a lot of financing people would say that sounds depressing and I don't want to do it. But you have people who are prepared to go ahead and do that.
Well, my take on it is not to show you all the depressing stuff. In fact, with a man who is going to die, I have a very vivid conversation. And you have the feeling for 20 minutes he's completely oblivious that he's in a cage, that he's going to die in 8 days, and he's back into childhood experiences.
He does have the most unnatural smile of anyone that I've ever seen with a death hanging over them.
However, as boyish... he looked like a lost kid. As much as he looked like that, I believe he was dangerous. But I can only say it from my gut feelings.
Right.
Otherwise, you'd be very, very, very careful to, like a jury, I would never make a decision from my gut feeling. He looks guilty. So no, rely on evidence, rely on witnesses,
right.
Rely on the entire court procedure.
But in terms of the financing aspect, people were your supporters who have worked with you before said, do they just say if it's interesting to you, it's interesting to us?
No, it has to be something where everybody almost immediately agreed this is something very, very big and this will fascinate audiences as well. Into the Abyss is going to be shown theatrically first and then later there will be DVDs and later probably in April, maybe May or so, Discovery will air it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with prolific filmmaker Werner Herzog. His latest movie, Into the Abyss, is a documentary about a triple homicide and the man sentenced to die for his role in it. Forever fearless, Herzog declares emphatically that he will not let anyone or anything stand in the way of his work. Now 69 years old, he hopes to inspire others to take the same approach.
When I'm talking to young filmmakers, aspiring filmmakers, film students, I always keep telling them, today it is fairly easy to make a feature film for, let's say, $10,000 and earn the money. Don't wait for financiers. Don't waste your life to promote your project and to appeal to the financiers in the studios for years and years and years. It's just a waste of time. It's loss of life, not only waste of life. Just roll up your sleeves, work at the forefront where there is real vigorous life. And I keep telling them, I rather would like to see you working as a bouncer in a sex club, work as a guard in a lunatic asylum or something like this.
Something that
earn
stimulates your mind as you in your storytelling?
When you are into filmmaking, you have to have the finger on the pulse of real life, of real raw, essential, fundamental life. So do that. Work for half a year and then you can make the film. The instruments, the cameras are very inexpensive and high caliber digital. You can edit your film at home on your laptop. So just go out and do it. There's no excuse anymore. Today, there's no excuse.
Now, I have to ask you about The Shoe. You famously ate The Shoe. You challenged Errol Morris, a filmmaker in the 70s, to finish a film about a pet cemetery.
Yes.
He finished the film.
His first film, yes.
And why did you issue this challenge?
Because Errol Morris, at that time when I met him back in Berkeley, had abandoned too many things. He had... stopped playing the cello. He was a prodigy as a cello player. He had given up a book project where he had collected thousands of pages of conversations with mass murder people and people around a mass murder case in Wisconsin. He had somehow abandoned his studies. And he talked about doing a film now. And I said to him, Errol, this is a project you better finish now. I'm completely on your side, but you better finish it.
How did you know him?
I met him around the Pacific Film Archive under Tom Luddy at that time, the best place for viewing films and debating films and a wonderful audience. And I ran into Errol Morris and nobody really took him that seriously. And I was immediately intrigued by his intellect and by his quick wit and by his erudition. And I said to him, Errol, you better finish that one now. And we were sitting at a coffee table and I said to him, these shoes that I'm wearing now, I'm going to eat when I see your film for the first time. And actually I did. I cooked them and I ate them.
How did you do that, cook them? What kind of shoe was it?
ankle-high Clark's Desert Boots with a vicious kind of sole
that
melted away like cheese in a pizza. Of course, I didn't eat the sole. But at Chez Panisse, at this wonderful restaurant, which was our place where we would meet because we all knew Alice Waters, who founded it. And she helped me cooking it and stuffing garlic into it and spices. And I cooked it in duck fat. But in duck, I reckoned duck fat would have had a boiling point at a much higher temperature than water. But what I didn't calculate right, in duck fat, leather shrinks and became tougher and tougher.
Oh, dear.
So I could only eat the shoes by cutting it into little fragments with a pair of poultry shears. And I had to swallow it down. I drank a whole six-pack of beer. I only remember that I was quite drunk after all this.
You did it in public.
I didn't mean to eat this shoe in public. I intended to eat it in the restaurant, but I was pushed a little bit into it, and it makes sense to some extent. Because it should be an encouragement for all of you who want to make films and who are just scared to start and who haven't got the guts. So you can follow a good example.
I mean, you could have said, it's an expression. I don't literally mean that I'm going to eat my shoe. And yet you did.
No, I meant it literally. I take things literally all the time. And if you put a challenge out like that, you're better...
You follow up.
Yes.
Well, what about acting? You're going to be in a movie, one shot with Tom Cruise. You are going to be a villain. You're going to be the bad guy.
I'm always good as a villain. I'm very good when it comes to hostile, dysfunctional characters. If it comes to a dangerous character, yes, I'm also good. And of course, when it comes to a big studio film, Paramount, and Tom Cruise being the good guy, they really look into the materials that I have done as an actor. And they have tested other actors, apparently, and they found out, yes, they look dangerous when they come at you with a big gun, or they are dangerous when they start to talk. And Tom Cruise apparently said, the one who is dangerous before he even talks is Herzog. I can really be dysfunctional and vile and debased.
What is that from?
I don't know. It's
you don't seem like that guy.
I am not the guy in personal life. I'm not that kind of guy. Ask my wife. She will testify to you that I'm a fluffy husband.
Coming up after a short break, filmmaker Werner Herzog talks about teaching his students to forge film permits and pick locks. To make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness and find a link to the 1980 Les Blank short film, Werner Herzog Eats His Shoe. You're listening to The Business from KCRW and kcrw.com.
Hi, this is Darby Maloney, producer of The Business. If you like this show, you'll probably also like other KCRW programs, such as Good Food, Bookworm, The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell, and Unfictional. You'll find them all in the podcast section of iTunes and on your KCRW smartphone app.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Werner Herzog is a German filmmaker, but he's made his home in Los Angeles for the past 12 years. Given his reputation as someone who works outside the system, we were a little surprised to find him living in L.A.
I fell in love with my wife 17 years ago, and I decided to move here. She loved California. Actually, she originally coming from Siberia, became a citizen and wanted to stay, and I decided, yes, this is a wonderful thing. And we moved to Los Angeles because we made the decision we have to move into the city with the most substance in the United States, cultural substance.
And that wasn't New York.
New York is more on the receiving end. It's more on the consuming end. But, I mean, Los Angeles, this is the place where things get done. This is the place. If you look beyond the glitz and glamour of Hollywood, you find all the writers, all the photographers, all the musicians, all the mathematicians, even one of the greatest magicians, Ricky Jay. I mention his name because he's a friend. This is a place you have to go. And what I'm telling you is just the banalities of the future. In 15 years, everybody will say the same thing.
What, that Los
that
Angeles,
Los Angeles is the city with the most
creative energy and
yes,
vitality
and
that way?
Yes.
Do you feel like you go to industry things and sort of network around like a regular Hollywood type?
I've never been on a red carpet event.
Count your blessings.
And I have never been at parties, not in 12 years, maybe twice at a party, but just in order to meet one particular person. But I'm completely low-key. People are completely surprised, asking me, where did you fly in? I said, I didn't fly in. I just came by, and it's 15 minutes by car from here. Ah, you live here? Yes, of course. Since when? Since 12 years.
So I'm not the only one who's surprised.
Well, take it as it is. I love to be here.
So let me ask you about the Rogue Film School. You created a thing called the Rogue yeah. Film School, which I don't know how long it's been in existence exactly.
About 2 years, but it doesn't have a fixed location. I can do it anywhere.
Does it meet at a regular time?
Infrequent intervals. Whenever I have some time for it to do it, because I check into all the applications. I view every single film that is being sent to me because I would not allow amateurs into it. There has to be someone who has already made a film or a short film at least. And I have a mandatory reading list, which has nothing to do with literature on movie making. It's poetry, like, let's say, Roman antiquity, Virgil or Hemingway, or even the Warren Commission report in it.
That is an eclectic list.
A fantastic piece of reading. But the whole thing comes as an answer to an avalanche of people, young people who are coming at me for the last 20, 25 years. And when I announce a new Rogue Film School, which I just have done now for January here in Los Angeles, I get hundreds and hundreds of applications, and I select a very small group so that I can still talk with every single one. Every single one has to have the possibilities to express their perspectives, their visions, their problems, their fears, whatever. So,
I mean, how do you instruct them? They're supposed to make a film in the space of a couple.
No, I do not instruct them. I just tell them, send me a short film, 5 minutes long. If you have a long film, please select only a 5-minute sequence from it. Some of them are undisciplined and send me 3 of their feature films.
I'm sure that is a gong for you. You're just not going to do that.
No, I couldn't. I couldn't watch hundreds and hundreds of long feature films or endless what sort of materials that they are sending me. Be disciplined, make a clear selection, send me what you like best.
Mm. And then are you the only teacher?
I'm the only one, yes.
And then what are you?
Not teacher. It's hard to say. Well, I teach a few things, like, for example, how to pick a lock, how to forge a document like a shooting permit. And I have done
how to forge one so that they can fake a shooting permit.
Yes. Okay. And I have done that quite frequently. For example, Fitzcarraldo wouldn't have been made with a forged shooting permit. What I didn't know at the time, it was during the military dictatorship, there was a border war building up between Peru and Ecuador, military camps all over the river, and they stopped me by shooting at me. So I better stopped, and a colonel said to me, what are you doing here? I said, I'm preparing a film. I need to move this ship further upriver. He said, no, nobody passes here without permit. I said, well, I have a shooting permit. But it's in Lima, and 4 days later I came with this permit, and it was in flowery
official language,
and it had lots of stamps and seals on the last page, and it was even signed by the Peruvian president.
Belaunde,
Belaunde, el presidente de la República, and the colonel looked at it and saluted and said, "Pass on."
And it was completely fake.
Completely forged, and I took pride into signing as Belaunde, the president of the republic.
Because you feel that you should be able to film where you want to film? I mean, get people in trouble with breaking locks.
No, I'm not where I feel to shoot, but I had the feeling there was something not right with stopping me, and it was a military dictatorship.
But so if you nothing tell wrong people about to that. Pick a lock or forge a document, they could obviously get into trouble.
Not if they are smart enough not to be caught. And that's the key to it. Yes, do something like a forged document, but do not get caught. That's the key to it. But let me put it this way. I get over with this lock picking and forging of documents within the first hour. So, and then it's other things, of course. It's more like a way of life, a way of following your vision. How do you become self-reliant? How do you survive within the industry as it is?
So I'm hoping that we might be able to cover the film school that you're planning.
No, you won't.
We won't allow it.
I do not allow anyone from the media, because the students have to be in a position where they can utter half-baked ideas,
right,
where they can voice their fears, where they can voice their doubts, where I would, for example, take a very hard look at one or the other of their films and tell them, this went wrong, but I took you because there's a wonderful, ingenious moment in there. Hang on to that stuff. So, and you see, there must be no media looking at everyone, and then you do not feel free to speak like that anymore.
What if we forge a document so that it says we have been enrolled in your class?
Take my word, I would spot you.
You would spot me like that?
I would spot you, and besides, you have to send a real good application, a written application, and you have to send a film that is convincing to me.
Oh, well, maybe I could.
I would not exclude it, but I have no idea. But I think I would spot you as a fraud,
okay,
as the one who tries to sneak in.
I don't know. I will not do it. But I would love to be able to in a parallel universe see whether I could slip by. Werner Herzog is a filmmaker. His latest movie is Into the Abyss. Thank you so much for coming to see us.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. To make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to us on demand with our KCRW smartphone apps, and you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.